Sam Borden, you traveled to Serbia for this piece you've done on Novak Djokovic, who happens to be the number one tennis player in the world, the guy who is currently tied with Roger Federer all time for Grand Slam titles with 20, the guy who is about to start his quest for number 21 on Sunday in Paris, which would tie him for first all time, of course, with Rafa Nadal. So what is on the line for Novak Djokovic at Roland Garros?
You know, Pablo, I kind of think it's a little bit of everything. There's the tennis side that you were just talking about. Obviously, he is one of the incredible talents in the sport in history and is trying to rack up the Grand Slam titles that will leave him in that position long term. But I think also, for me, it's really about Novak Djokovic, the person. What happened to him in January when he was deported from Australia, that was the kind of story that was seen all over the world.
The Australian Open is about to begin in Melbourne without its defending men's champion. Novak Djokovic has been deported after losing his legal challenge to the cancelling of his visa. The judges ruled in favour of the Australian government, who said his refusal to be vaccinated against COVID made him a threat to public health.
For the vast majority of, you know, the casual sports fans, the ones who don't watch tennis every week, the French Open, which begins this weekend, is going to be the first time that they've thought about Novak Djokovic since that story in January. In a lot of ways, it's his re-entry onto the biggest stage. But I also think from Djokovic's perspective, it's an opportunity to try to right the reputation that took a hit, clearly, in January. This is a guy, Pablo, who has been a divisive figure in tennis for a long time. And frankly,
yes,
he wishes that he were seen in the same way that Roger Federer and Rafa Nadal are. He wants to be this beloved figure, and he's not.
The cruel irony of wanting to be liked is that all of that wanting, all of that thirst, it all tends to be the problem. It tends to be at least one big reason why lots of people are disliked in the first place. But Novak Djokovic, it is worth mentioning, is not most people. The guy is the number one tennis player in the world at age 34 after starting out in his native Serbia. Novak Djokovic is also arguably the number one tennis player of all time, even after everything that happened in Australia this year. So today, Sam Borden helps us understand the full story of Novak Djokovic, who is trying to rewrite it as we speak. I'm Pablo Torre. It's Friday, May 20th. This is ESPN Daily. So, Sam, I want to get into Serbia with you, where you just were. But before we get there, we need to go back to Australia, a place that Novak Djokovic clearly has no real desire to return to, I would argue, after what happened a couple months ago in January at the Australian Open, because it was supposed to be a celebration for the guy. And it became something else that I'm still trying to understand, something else that is still kind of confusing. So what exactly happened there?
Pablo, you're definitely not the only one that was confused by what happened there. It's funny, I was talking to my wife, who is not a sports fan, before I went to Serbia, and I said, oh, I'm going to do this story about Novak Djokovic. And she said, oh, that's the guy that tried to sneak into Australia, right? Because that was what she took away from, you know, the sort of massive coverage of what happened in January. And I think that, like you, like her, a lot of people didn't really follow all of the twists and turns that that whole saga took because it was pretty confusing. The basic premise of what happened is that Australia had and has really intense COVID protocols in terms of who's allowed to enter that country. And at that time, if you were unvaccinated, much like in the United States, if you're not a citizen, coming into the country wasn't allowed. But Djokovic showed up to play the Australian Open because he had been offered an exemption by the state government in Melbourne, where the Open is held, that said, okay, fill out these forms and let us know about your COVID history. He'd had COVID in December, and you'll be allowed to enter and play in the tournament. The most important thing to understand about Djokovic's situation is that he was offered that invitation by the state government. And for most of the pandemic, the various states in Australia had been left alone by the federal government to make those kinds of entry decisions on their own.
Right.
So Djokovic arrived in Melbourne under the assumption that his exemption would be fine. He would go through immigration at the airport like everybody else, and he would go to Melbourne and play in the Open. While he was en route to Australia, a real social media uproar happened where lots of Australian citizens all of a sudden were kind of like, wait a minute, my family can't come to Australia if they're not vaccinated. Why is this guy, this Serbian, allowed to come to Australia when he's not vaccinated?
I think it's a disgrace. We've all done the right thing. We've all gone out and got our jabs and our boosters, and we have someone that's come from overseas, and all of a sudden he's been exempt and can play, and I think it's an absolute disgrace, and I won't be watching it.
There was a real uprising, and so while Djokovic was en route to Australia, the federal government said, hang on a minute, this seems like a PR disaster waiting to happen. We've been really intense about our COVID protocols. We think Djokovic's visa should be canceled.
Dramatic developments this morning at Melbourne Airport, with Border Force officials revoking Novak Djokovic's visa to enter Australia.
After hours in what his father says was a small room being held under armed guard, his visa was revoked.
As much as we've talked about like Kyrie Irving and Aaron Rodgers in the States, Sam, what happens here in this story is kind of incredible in all sorts of senses. So what did Novak Djokovic do as the federal government of Australia now is working against him?
He did what you would expect, right? He hired a local attorney and he appealed. He wanted to play the Australian Open. And this is where the story gets a little bit tricky, Pablo, because he actually won that appeal. An Australian judge said, you know what? He did everything that you asked him to do. He should be given this exemption. There's no reason that he shouldn't be allowed to enter the country based on what we see in terms of this filing. And there were some things working against Djokovic from a PR perspective. He posted on Instagram about the whole saga. There was news about how before he even came to Australia, he had met with a French journalist a day after learning that he tested positive for COVID in December, didn't tell that French reporter. So obviously not looking as though he's paying too close attention to the COVID protocols, and that didn't help his case. But the bottom line was the federal government changed its argument, and they said that, okay, now Djokovic should be deported and his visa canceled because he represented a threat to public health in Australia, that Djokovic's mere presence in Australia would inspire the anti-vax movement, which is fairly small in Australia for what it's worth, and would negatively affect the public health in Australia.
The verdict is in. Novak Djokovic is out at the Australian Open. The final decision rendered by three judges in a court hearing late Saturday. Djokovic, one Grand Slam win away from the most ever, will not get a chance to break the record at the 2022 Australian Open.
The Australian immigration minister took advantage of what is being called in sort of legal circles, God powers, which essentially meant that Djokovic couldn't appeal this particular choice. In the end, the Australian immigration minister overruled that Australian judge and said, you know what? Djokovic is a threat to public health. We're sending him home.
So we're now months removed from the invocation of God powers, a term that I wasn't familiar with, but what I plan on using a lot now that I have learned about it. But what do you make of that decision, of those powers in retrospect now, the decision to deport Novak Djokovic by the government?
I think that, like a lot of people, I didn't follow the initial situation so closely. In my mind, I thought, hey, Djokovic is probably the villain here.
Same.
I came into the reporting of the story thinking that, like, he had done something wrong. And the truth is that as I went back over and reported the details and talked to people who know, like, what God powers are, it became clear to me that certainly Djokovic shouldn't have met with that French reporter and probably made some pretty serious missteps in terms of his own respect of COVID protocols in Serbia and with other people. Mm-hmm. But in terms of getting into Australia and playing in that Australian Open, I think he got screwed, honestly. And I think that when I reported more deeply into sort of what had happened, I came across a paper that an Australian professor at the University of Oxford, this guy, Andrew Higgins, he wrote in Civil Justice Quarterly, which I don't read regularly. I don't know if you do, but...
Yeah, I love Civil Justice Quarterly swimsuit issue, Sam.
But the way that Andrew Higgins described it was, he said, the government's decision was coupled with no discernible policy, lawful or not, merely executive whim. The government seemingly deported him because it could, believing it would be popular to do so. And I think that's a pretty accurate summary, right? Like, in the end, like in America, like in so many countries around the world, COVID has become as much a political issue as a public health issue. And that's what happened to Djokovic in Australia. He was trying to go play a tournament in a country that has been really fastidious about its vaccination policy and about the intensity with which it permits people to come in and out of its borders. And he tried to show up into that country as an unvaccinated individual. And in the end, for politicians who are always running for re-election, that presented a public relations problem. And so the politicians did what they needed to do. They sent Djokovic home.
So after all of this, Sam, Novak Djokovic is left isolated, right? In a literal sense, in a figurative sense, and the impact on him, as you now understand it, as a psychological matter, as an athletic matter, how would you describe that?
It's multi-layered, like you just said, right? I mean, he flies home from Australia, which is a long way to go to Serbia, by the way. The bottom line is he can't do much in professional tennis, right? I mean, he was kicked out of Australia. The U.S. has similar entry policies, and so he had to miss out on the sort of big Masters-level tournaments that were in California and Miami not long after the Australian Open. And he's sort of just sitting alone. He's training, he's practicing, he's trying to stay in shape. But, you know, the run-up between the Australian Open up to the French Open into the clay court season is a pretty busy time, typically, for tennis players. And Djokovic wasn't doing much. I think that it really did affect him both physically, but also mentally. When I was in Belgrade, I talked to Viktor Troicki, who's a retired Serbian pro, and he's one of Djokovic's closest friends. And I remember him telling me that for the past 2 years, he felt that everyone in the world had been looking for someone to blame for the pandemic. And what had happened in Australia set Djokovic up to be that blame, right? That figure who took the negative emotion that everybody was feeling about this pandemic. And Troicki said it wasn't fair to him at all. And I think that Djokovic felt the exact same way and certainly told his friends that he felt that way, that he felt as though he'd been painted into a corner. He's not anti-vax for the whole world. He might be anti-vax for himself, but he certainly understands the rights of others to make their own choices. But he was painted as the sort of face of the anti-vax movement. And I think he wasn't comfortable with that label at all.
He returns home to Belgrade after all of that, and he goes to play in the Serbian Open. And here we are, it's April, and you're there, Sam, on the scene to witness this. What is the scene like when he's back home in Belgrade?
He arrived in Belgrade hoping to be sort of this figurehead, this, you know, superstar, right? I mean, his brother is the tournament director of the tournament. The tournament is played at the Novak Tennis Center. The Wi-Fi password in the main building at the Novak Tennis Center is Nole, N-O-L-E, which is his childhood nickname. So, I mean, like...
A little on the nose. Yeah, a little easy to guess, I would imagine.
Right, I was just going to say, it's one of those where if you don't know it, you probably could get it in a couple of shots. But, you know, all of it, Pablo, was sort of built up to be this amazing experience, this sort of, you know, restorative experience for Djokovic. And in the end, it wasn't quite exactly that.
How does it go for him in this bounce back opportunity?
He arrived in Belgrade saying that he was still feeling the effects of a virus that he picked up in February and March. I asked him if it was COVID related or long COVID, and he said no. He said he doesn't believe so, but that it had affected his metabolism. But You know, it's funny, Pablo. I got there on Monday, I think, and Djokovic's first match was on Wednesday. He had a bye. He was the top seed, and he had a bye. And for most of Wednesday night, when the match was going on, I was thinking that I might be going home on Thursday because he's playing this young Serbian, Laszlo Djere, who is middle of the road in terms of competitors, a very talented player, but certainly not the kind of guy you would expect to trouble Djokovic. And I got to tell you, Djere won the first set, was in position to win the second set and send Djokovic out of the tournament, you know, after one night.
Yeah. It has gone wide, and he's gone into trouble here. Djokovic now down a set and a break in the second.
And he just kind of gives it away, Pablo. I mean, this is a young Serbian, and it's like he can't imagine what it's going to take for him to beat the number one Serbian athlete of all time.
The number one athlete who's ever played tennis of all time, according to popular acclamation. The most complete player, Sam, is what lots of experts call Novak Djokovic.
Totally. And so I think in the end, he just sort of buckles under the pressure, and Djokovic ends up winning the match in three sets.
Game, set, match.
Novak Djokovic does find a way back to winning ways. A Houdini-like escape from the clutches of Laszlo Djere.
And you think, okay, well, he'll just roll from here. But the truth is, Pablo, he made it to the final, but nothing was easy about this for Djokovic. He looked tired. He looked sluggish. He looked like the kind of player who was really struggling to find his game.
So in the final, Sam, Djokovic goes on to face Andrei Rublev, and again, he is forcing a match-deciding third set. And what happens next?
You know what happens, Pablo? He takes a medical timeout between the second and third set because he is looking really tired. He's looking really weak, even as he wins the second set tiebreak. And so he goes inside for a few minutes before the third set begins. The crowd is getting anxious. Oh, is he going to come back out? What's going to happen? He comes back out. There's this huge ovation. You're like, all right, he's going to go forward and win this third set. And then he loses 6-love in the third set.
Andrei Rublev is the Serbia Open champion. For the first time, he is able to get the better of Novak Djokovic.
It was like the biggest anticlimax I've ever seen. Everybody was like, okay, this guy's going to have this amazing moment in front of his home crowd. And Andrei Rublev probably has never played an easier set in his life. It was crazy, Pablo.
In other words, Sam, this is not the sort of tune-up that you'd expect before heading to Paris.
No. The emotional takeaway was really one that was more of a downer than the kind of, you know, rising tide that he was looking for. In the end, he's sitting in his chair looking at Andrei Rublev hold the trophy that everybody was expecting he was going to be holding.
Coming up, gluten allergies, telekinesis, and the other strange methodologies of Novak Djokovic.
Delicious, meat, nutritious. In the snack that packs a real protein punch, wonderful pistachios, one of the highest protein nuts out there. Each 1 ounce serving has 6 grams of protein, giving you over 10% of your daily value. Trust me, I've been eating them like there's no tomorrow all week. Wonderful pistachios also come in a variety of flavors and sizes, perfect for enjoying with your family and friends or taking them with you on the go. And you, like me, are on the go a lot, taking the kids to school, hopping from meeting to meeting, shopping for groceries, whatever it may be. Well, the good news is not only are Wonderful pistachios a complete protein providing all 9 essential amino acids, they're also great for all your adventures. So whether you're a pistachio purist who loves cracking open every nut or you prefer the convenience of no-shells pistachios, Wonderful Pistachios has got you covered. Grab Wonderful Pistachios and elevate your snack game today. Visit WonderfulPistachios.com to learn more.
So, Sam, the other thing I should confess that I'm fascinated by when it comes to Novak Djokovic is how weird his whole training methodology, let's call it, has been. And I want you to explain this to me because you've reported extensively now about his alternative diets, about the alternative medicine that he favors. And a lot of it seems to stem from something that happened to him in 2010, actually. So take us there. What happened?
Early in Djokovic's career, he was known as a talented player for sure, but he was also known for being the kind of guy that often would talk about how he was injured or would retire matches early. There's like a famous line Andy Roddick, I think, once said about Djokovic that it was like, he must be the most courageous player in the world because like every match there's, you know, a bulky back, there's a hamstring, you know, there's something that is always bothering him. And it inhibited Djokovic's, you know, rise as a player. But then in 2010, he's playing in the Australian Open against Joe Willisonga. And it is a really difficult match. Like, it goes on for hours and hours and hours, and Djokovic is clearly laboring.
And the double ball. You can see that one coming, and Djokovic is hurting in more ways than one.
Watching on TV in Cyprus is a Bosnian Serb doctor named Dr. Igor Cetojevic. He is not a tennis fan. He just happens to be watching the match because his wife is a tennis fan. And he's listening to the commentary of the broadcasters who are looking at Djokovic really struggling in this match. And the commentators speculate that Djokovic's problem could be that he has asthma. And Dr. Igor Cetojevic in Cyprus, watching this match, says to his wife, "There is no way that's asthma. I'm looking at this guy. I can see it's not asthma. He has other problems." And his wife says, "Well, you have Serbian heritage. He's a Serb. You should help him." And so Dr. Igor Cetojevic sets up a meeting with Djokovic several months later. He meets him in a restaurant and he says, "I can help fix your problems. I think that you have a food allergy." And to prove that Djokovic has a food allergy, he goes through this sort of elaborate but very memorable exercise in which he says, "Novak, hold out one hand and put your other hand against your belly." Djokovic does it, and Cetojevic reaches out and tries to push down on the hand that Djokovic is holding out. And he says, "Resist me, resist me." And Djokovic resists him. He succeeds. Cetojevic can't push the hand down. And then Cetojevic gives Djokovic a piece of bread. And he says, "I don't want you to eat this piece of bread. I just want you to hold it against your belly."
Wait. So, like bread to belly.
Yeah. And Djokovic does this. And Cetojevic reaches out and tries to push down on his hand. And this time, Djokovic can't hold his hand up. His hand goes down.
Man.
Cetojevic, when I spoke to him on the phone, he described this entire thing to me. And then he says he was clearly weaker. And that showed that his body was resisting wheat.
I mean, Sam, look, I am no doctor. I will say that this doesn't exactly seem like it would be passing the scientific smell test if you were to describe the skin to crust dynamic that you've given us.
I am not a doctor either, Pablo. I did not go to medical school. I didn't even stay in a Holiday Inn Express the night before I had this conversation. But the bottom line is Djokovic believed it, right?
I mean, if the hand goes down, Sam, this speaks to something that is, if not scientifically replicable, something that is real to him.
Exactly. And so he bought in on Dr. Igor Cetojevic and his Eastern medicine, Eastern philosophy sort of outlook. He did some more tests and ultimately decided that he was allergic to gluten and immediately began keeping a vegan diet, which is fairly remarkable if you know anything about both Serbian cuisine, which has, you know, a lot of bread in it generally,
right,
but also the fact that Djokovic's parents owned a pizza parlor when he was growing up. So, like, you know, this is pretty remarkable stuff. And the bottom line is that Djokovic sees Dr. Igor Sedejevic and this entire experience as sort of a turning point in his career. And from a performance perspective, it really was. I mean, after 2010, that's when his career takes off astronomically and he becomes this guy who plays on the same level, if not above, Nadal and Federer, as opposed to the guy who's sort of nipping at their heels. And so
yeah,
you can see why he would buy in on it.
Well, I mean, look, the placebo effect of positive thinking, Sam, yeah. if that's what we're dealing with here, it worked, right? Like, that's the bottom line here. Whatever got him to the point of being the greatest in the world, he became the greatest in the world. And it seems like on that level, his views about food and drink, he's pretty confident in it.
Yeah, I mean, it's not just, you know, veganism. It's not just the gluten allergy. You know, this is a guy that has said openly that he believes in telekinesis, that he believes that cold water sits in your belly longer, and so he only drinks room temperature water. This is a guy who's said that he believes that water molecules have emotional properties and that positive thinking can turn toxic food or polluted water into the most healing kind of water, right? I mean,
sure.
This is a guy who clearly comes at life from a different perspective than the Western mainstream.
And so this framework of belief, how did that sort of map onto his decision as the vaccine is concerned?
I think is pretty emblematic of where he comes at, again, sort of mainstream Western medicine. And so it wasn't surprising at all that Djokovic decided not to get vaccinated and was not necessarily interested in following the protocols that even the Serbian government and the Serbian public health officials were saying, look, we need people to get vaccinated. But in a lot of ways, Pablo, Djokovic's philosophy is also emblematic of many Serbians. This is a country where the vaccination rate is less than 50%. And when he was detained in Australia, a lot of people, a lot of Serbians living in Serbia were seeing him as a hero, seeing him as somebody who was pushing back against what they saw as restrictive policies from the Australian and other Western governments around the world. And so when I talked to Sedejevic, the guy who, you know, who sort of helped turn Djokovic towards Eastern medicine.
Yeah, the bread guy. Yeah, right. Sorry. That's how I'm going to refer to him now for all time is the bread
yes,
guy.
Yes, he's the bread guy. Right, yes. When I talked to the bread guy, Sedejevic, he said to me that he sees Djokovic as almost akin to Martin Luther King Jr. in terms of how he's seen something different than what the rest of the world is seeing when it comes to the pandemic. Obviously, that comparison is fairly absurd, Pablo.
Yeah,
but I
yeah.
think what he was getting at was he believes that Djokovic was doing the right thing. He believes that Djokovic was doing the thing that makes sense in his mind and in Sedejevic's mind. When Djokovic was stuck in Australia waiting for his various appeals to be heard, Sedejevic sent him a text message that said, "How many people have been in jail for what they believe? You are a light for human rights." And I think that that is probably not an altogether unusual perspective for a Serbian to have on what Djokovic went through.
After the break, we take a trip to Serbia and one bomb shelter in specific.
Now let's talk about the play of the week. The pressure to follow up Hypnotic and Cognac weighing heavy on the team. Hypnotic was in the cup, blue, and ready for the play. And boom, Añejo Tequila came in with the smooth assist to Hypnotic's tropical fruit finish. Shaken, strained, poured, it was green and good. The playmaking splash shifted the tempo, another great cocktail from the Hypnotic team. Every season is Hypnotic and Tequila season. Hypnotic Liqueur, Bardstown, Kentucky, 17% alcohol by volume. Hypnotic reminds you to think wisely, drink wisely. Vivid Seats wants to get you to the games you love this spring. Experience every pitch, assist, and game-winning shot live and in person. And the best part? Each transaction is a step toward a free 11th ticket with Vivid Seats rewards. Score unbeatable perks like free tickets, surprise seat upgrades, and annual birthday deals. As the official ticketing partner of ESPN, Vivid Seats is offering you $20 off your first $200 ticket purchase with code DAILY. That's code DAILY. Visit VividSeats.com or download the app today. Vivid Seats. Experience it live.
Sam, let's just recap this year, right? Novak Djokovic has 20 Grand Slam titles. He has the record for time spent as the number one player in the world, now at 370 weeks and counting. He is just ridiculously talented. He is remarkably decorated as a tennis player. And so the question for me, even beyond the bread and the health and COVID stuff, is why he has not been revered anywhere close to Federer and Nadal.
Yeah, it's not like he's the only really talented athlete in the world who has a pretty unusual perspective or goes away from the mainstream on some of his views, right? I mean,
no.
He is certainly not alone in that regard. Tom Brady's pretty popular, but Djokovic has never been able to sort of get to that level of adoration that Federer and Nadal have had almost their entire careers. And I think in the beginning, part of it was that he was the disruptor, right? He was the guy who was coming in to sort of break up this Federer-Nadal thing. And the various followings that Federer and Nadal have are really strong and really well established. And so Djokovic was this kind of like new guy in town. And I think, you know, in the beginning, there was a lot of like, okay, well, things are going pretty well with Federer and Nadal. We like these guys. Who's this other guy? But then even as he became more successful, even as he began to beat these guys with some regularity, it still didn't change. And so I think a lot of people around Djokovic, in my reporting, I got the sense that there is still this feeling that there's a little bit of an Eastern Bloc issue here, right? Mm. Tennis is a traditional sport. It's covered largely by a media that has its footprint in Western Europe, Australia, and the United States. And the sort of coverage bends towards the players that fit that mold. And Federer, who's like, you know, out of a Swiss watch commercial from, you know, from diapers, he fits that mold perfectly. And Nadal, you know, Spanish flair, creativity, personality.
Yes, bandana, biceps,
yes,
all of it.
He fits perfectly. And Djokovic doesn't. And Serbia doesn't. This is former Yugoslavia. Djokovic was an outsider in a lot of ways. He describes himself as a child of war. When Djokovic was growing up as a, you know, 9, 10, 11, 12-year-old, there were bombs dropping. There were wars being fought.
The first bombing of its kind in NATO history. On March 24, 1999, Western nations carried out their threat against Serbia and began the biggest military conflict on Serbian soil since World War II.
His 12th birthday party, Pablo, was at a tennis club in Belgrade, and literally as his parents are leading the kids and singing happy birthday, warplanes are flying overhead. They were in the midst of the NATO bombings that lasted for 78 nights.
Yeah, the US-led NATO bombings, incidentally.
Exactly, 100%. At the time, NATO was trying to defeat Slobodan Milosevic, and he was a dictator, and there was all types of ethnic cleansing. I mean, this is real stuff. While I was in Belgrade, Pablo, I actually went to the apartment building where his grandfather had an apartment where Djokovic spent so many of those nights. And the super in that building agreed to open the bunker up for me. I'd never been in a bunker like this before, but it was really remarkable. You know, you go down these stairs and he pulls open this giant steel door and you go in and the smell is the thing that I'll remember most. It's just musty. You're underground. It's very cramped. Literally, the residents of the building, Pablo, had set up a stationary bike and jerry-rigged this like rudimentary electrical setup where one person would pedal on the stationary bike, and that would provide enough power to keep just a few light bulbs lit all the way through the night. It was really hard for me to imagine young children night after night in a place like this. And you're a 12-year-old, and all you're trying to do is find a place to play tennis. He and his coach, during these bombings, every morning they would get up and they would go around Belgrade looking for the sites that were the most damaged, the ones where there were craters in the ground from the night before, and they would try to play tennis near that damage because they figured, what are the chances that NATO's going to bomb the same area of the city 2 days in a row? Think about what that does to a kid, right? Think about what that does to the way that he sees the world around him, the way he sees the Western world. And so I think that when Djokovic reached the levels that he wanted to reach in professional tennis, he brought to professional tennis an attitude and a perspective that was really different than what tennis had seen before. And I think the bottom line is there was a lot of reticence to accept that.
So this guy who comes from that place, how do you think that's affected the way Novak Djokovic portrays himself to the public?
You know, Pablo, I think there is this push-pull, right? Because he wants to be seen as this proud Serbian, this guy who has helped bring his country forward that isn't, you know, the way that we remember the former Yugoslavia. So he wants to be that, but he also wants to fit in desperately. And when I think about that, I think back to early in his career where, you know, he was known as like the joker, the jester, right? This was a guy who was sort of known for being good at tennis, but also being really good at doing funny impressions of other players, right? I mean, you can imagine it. They're all over YouTube, right? Like, you know, he would go out on court and he would...
he was good at him.
Yeah.
He was good at him, Sam.
He would pretend to be Nadal, and he would fidget and he'd touch his headband and he'd pick his wedgie before every point, just like Nadal does. And he even put on like a tennis skirt and tried to, you know, portray Serena Williams at one point. And it was kind of like... okay, it was cool. It was like, all right, yeah, like you said, he was pretty good at it, but it also kind of smacked of, hey guys, look at this party trick that I can do, you know? Like, maybe you don't like where I'm from. Maybe I'm a little different. So let me just show you that I'm the funny man. And I think that that rubbed a lot of people the wrong way. Sure, he made some fans because of it, but I'll tell you this, Pablo, and I know it's a little bit random. When I was in Belgrade, I met up with Darko Milicic, right? Who was another Serbian athlete who couldn't quite get American fans to like him the way that he would have liked.
Yeah, if anyone, Sam, can relate to the struggle to be liked in America, it is Darko. It is the man who in the 2003 NBA draft was chosen number 2 overall behind LeBron James, but ahead of Carmelo Anthony and Chris Bosh and Dwayne Wade. And yeah, who is now considered, by the way, maybe the biggest bust in NBA history.
Exactly, right. And I did a story on Darko years ago and I stayed in touch with him. So I looked him up when I was there. And while we were catching up, I asked him what he thought of Djokovic. And he brought up the impressions. He was like, to me, when I saw that, it just made me realize how hard this guy is trying. Darko tried any number of things to fit into American culture and with American fans, and pretty much none of them worked. And so what he said to me was, look, I know this never works, okay? Like, you can try as much as you want. You can do all of these things. You can be the funny man, but it's not going to work. And after I had that lunch with Darko, a couple days later, I was with Djokovic's friend, Viktor Troitsky, and I told him about what Darko had said. And I said, do you think what Darko's saying makes sense? And Viktor Troitsky said to me, yeah, it does. He said, you know, I don't know why this matters so much to him. It shouldn't matter to him, but it does.
It's a 6th title for Djokovic in Rome, a 38th Masters trophy. But maybe, more importantly for Novak, it sends a message to his rivals ahead of Paris.
So, Sam, it's important to note here that after he loses in humiliating fashion at home in Serbia in that tournament, he wins outright the Italian Open, all of which portends better for him, heading into Roland Garros, heading into the French Open. So what are the expectations for this guy as we enter the weekend?
I think, like I was saying at the beginning, right? Like, the French Open is his return to the big stage. You know, the sort of casual sports world doesn't really pay attention to tennis other than the four majors. And this is one of those. And I think if you were looking for, okay, how is Djokovic doing as he kind of steps back onto stage? He's doing well. I mean, winning the Italian Open and doing it in a fairly dominant fashion, which he did, obviously portends good things for him, and he's feeling better about his game. I think the one thing I would say, though, is that he still hasn't played that many matches. You know, he still played maybe 60% of the number of sets he would have played like in a regular year, in a regular schedule. And so the fitness, which is the biggest issue that he's had, right? Remember, he was struggling with the virus, the aftermath of the virus, the metabolism. Now he's going into a tournament where he's going to have to win 7 best of 5 matches on clay. The French Open is the Grand Slam that takes the most out of you in a lot of ways because those matches are long, they are slogs. And Djokovic, generally, fitness is one of his strengths, but I think we've seen over the course of this year so far in Serbia and elsewhere that he's still trying to find his way in that regard.
So if Djokovic is going to struggle, Sam, if he's struggling to regain his own god powers, let's call them.
Yeah.
What is the reaction going to be? I mean, what's the reaction if he flames out and he is struggling in that way? What's the reaction if he actually pulls it off? Imagine that sort of contrast for me.
I think that if he flames out, then I think there will be a lot of attention paid to what happened in January again. The missed matches, the isolation, the time spent having to be on his own as opposed to playing in tournaments that he otherwise would have played in, I think that will all be revisited. There's no doubt that those two things will be linked, and I think appropriately so. If he wins, I think it will be sort of a more positive spin on the same thing. Look what happened to him in January, and now he's managed to work his way all the way back to the level that he was before, and he wins in Paris again. To me, Pablo, the bigger issue is, what does this do for Novak Djokovic writ large, right? What will happen to Novak Djokovic and the way that he is seen and the way he sees himself after Paris? I think the reality is that anybody that thought that he was a villain, both before and because of what happened in Australia, is still going to think that, whether he wins at Roland Garros or not. And so Djokovic tells himself, hey, keep winning, keep fighting. You'll finally get the adulation, the love that you've been chasing. I'm not so sure that even if he pulls off another Grand Slam in Paris, that he's ever actually going to get the thing that he's been looking for.
Yeah, Sam, it does feel like either you're a bread guy or you're not, regardless of how it goes in France.
Exactly.
Sam Borden, thank you as always for taking us around the world.
Thanks, Pablo.
I'm Pablo Torre. This has been ESPN Daily. Our show is produced by Bradford Craig, Alexander Hyacinth, Mike Johns, Ryan Nantel, Mike Philbrick, Andy Tennant, Eve Troh, Chris Tuminello, and Aaron Vale. Special thanks this week to Andre Soto, Scott Sikowski, and Jackson Ugelo. I'll talk to you Monday.